All right, great. If we're okay here. While we're talking about books, I might as well give credit where credit is due. If you think that these are primarily my words, they're not. Of course, Shepherding a Child's Heart is a big one, and we're in chapter 3 today. But there's another book that Ted Tripp and his wife Margie have published in 2006, and that's Instructing a Child's Heart. And I've actually used a chapter from that as well for today. It's a very, very helpful chapter. If you happen to get in that book, it's chapter 9. So, need the wisdom of lots of people who are more knowledgeable in parenting than I. Well, last week we kind of kicked off a consideration of parenting from the standpoint of where most people start and a lot of people finish, which is shaping influences. So I spoke about our tendency as parents to try and put together the ideal environment for our kids by orchestrating what we called last week shaping influences in the child's life. And together we identified a number of shaping influences, and we determined that some of those were beyond our control. So I need some input now to see if we remember anything from last week besides what I just said. So in terms of shaping influences, we didn't throw the whole idea out that we shouldn't be concerned about shaping influences, but I did use a metaphor like we have to walk a tightrope about shaping influences. So let me throw this out for discussion here for a moment. What are the two extremes with regard to shaping influences that we need to avoid? Two extremes. Give me one of them or both of them. Jeremy? So we show up on the mic here.
Behaviorism.
So what do you mean by behaviorism? That's a nice
label. The idea that you can basically ensure what you will get out by what you put in, almost a determinant.
Okay, an input-output model that essentially says by creating this environment, we end up determining what the outcome is going to be. So what's the other extreme? There isn't one, huh?
Determinism?
Well, I think that's going to be related to behaviorism if we take behaviorism to its conclusion. I mean, maybe it's not even an attractive option here, but some people would say what? I mean, does everybody try and orchestrate the environment for their kids? There are some people. Jennifer. Okay, let's get you on the mic. This is the only way it's going to show up on the recording.
Permissivism, when you just let children just kind of go their
own way. Okay, kind of explore options for themselves.
And make their own decisions.
Yeah, implicit in that is a sense of what about these shaping influences?
Basically letting peers influence them as opposed to adults? Or
well, they're out there, but a parent who would turn their kids loose to these shaping influences would essentially tacitly be saying what about them?
That they really have no influence?
Yeah, there's no harm done here. Their choice is probably as good as mine about these things. So those are two extremes, either to be focused in a behavioristic sense or to just let things happen. Let them be exposed to whatever happens because I can't control them anyway. Well, let's assume then that we're trying to drive down the middle here, and we're not behavioristic or deterministic in our thinking. And we certainly recognize that the Bible tells us as parents that we have some responsibilities in crafting a learning environment for our kids. What's inadequate about a perspective that focuses only on shaping influences? In other words, if the series was over last week, and it's not, what's inadequate about a perspective that just says, if you get the right viewpoint about shaping influences, you'll be okay? Jeremy.
Several things, but one of the things I think the unsaved people basically believe either nature or nurture predominates. And they don't take redemption into account. So they say, well, either you have this genetic predisposition or you came from a great home that helped you or didn't. But I don't know that they really believe in the interaction of Christ in changing people and the power of transforming grace. So that's probably the middle ground, and that's what's wrong with a behaviorist approach. You're really, I think, the point you're trying to make, not addressing the heart of the person.
Okay, so obviously we shouldn't be operating from a secularist perspective, as though God is not part of this. But as we're going to spend some time with, our kids aren't believers in God as they come from the womb. So even though we want them to be redeemed children of God, that's one of our goals for them down the road. If I'm only focusing on shaping influences, then taking this idea of redemption, then, how is my kid enter into the whole issue of parenting? Aaron?
Not being a parent.
That makes it easier.
Exactly. I can't speak from experience, but to a certain extent, I think sometimes we look not just at children, but at people in general, that they are free moral agents, either that they are innocent and can be influenced either to do wrong, right, or to do wrong, when in reality, and Jeremy, you did touch on this, and maybe this is just an extension of what you said, but we look at it as we can be influenced either for right or wrong, not taking into account that man's nature is, by nature, we are bent to do wrong. We are fallen, and we need the redemptive influence in our lives to do right. So it's not what's on the outside pushing us one way or the other, but rather it's the very nature of the heart that drives us to either away from God, or then through redemption can bring us to God.
Yeah, great. So we're talking about the child does have a bent, the child does have a reaction, the child does play into this. This is not simply us as parents trying to program robots through some set of conditions that we impose on them. Just so we can engage the picture that we had last week, I made the choice to talk about the mass murderer Jeffrey Dahmer. Anybody remember that illustration? Okay. And we're going to have a little bit more of Dahmer, and then we're going to end up with somebody much better than Jeffrey Dahmer. But what we illustrated last week with Jeffrey Dahmer was his parents, of course, were shocked at what he was responsible for. And ultimately, when we got all these reactions from psychologists, from his parents, the tendency there was to lay the blame on the formative influences in his life, right? His dad kind of scraped around to try and find something that would account for this. Anybody remember something like that? Right? So he looked at things like his own fascination with fire, for instance, and mother's tendency toward what he viewed as psychosomatic illness, and so forth. The blame was laid everywhere but at Jeffrey Dahmer's feet, right? Well, we might be interested in hearing what Dahmer said, because Jeffrey Dahmer was interviewed. And the worst thing he said about his shaping influences was that his parents bickered a lot, and he decided he wouldn't get married because of that. Okay? That's the worst thing he had to say about his family upbringing, that his parents' marriage was bad enough that he thought, no way, I'm ever going to get married. But Dahmer said some interesting things. Jeffrey Dahmer said, for instance, when I was a little kid, I was just like anybody else. Okay? That doesn't sound like somebody who actually, and I'm not saying there's anything redemptive about his viewpoint about this, but he simply was recognizing there wasn't anything that unusual about my shaping influences when I was a kid. In fact, he said this when he was reflecting on what he should have done. He said, I should have gone to college and gone into real estate and got myself an aquarium. That's what I should have done. Because he really liked fish in an aquarium. Fairly modest goals, huh? So on later in the interview, he says, I don't know why it, and it here refers to killing people, I don't know why it started. I don't have any definite answers on that myself. If I knew the true, real reasons why all this started before it ever did, I wouldn't probably have done any of it. In other words, if I could see this coming up, I probably wouldn't have ever done it. And obviously, he gave himself a little bit more credit. If he didn't recognize the connection between what was going on in his heart for a long period of time, that he harbored there for years before this erupted in killing a person the first time. I mean, Mark chapter 7, verses 21 through 23 say, for from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, evil, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. Dahmer also said, I was completely swept along with my own compulsion. Notice it's my own compulsion. I don't know how else to put it. And so we might ask, compulsion to what? Well, compulsion really means the things that give meaning to my life, that I just feel compelled to do because my life is meaningless. And you get to the bottom of it, and Dahmer wanted to have control over other people. He was a social misfit, but he could control people. And really the ultimate in controlling somebody to show you have power over them is to kill them. And Dahmer recognized also that his life was being orchestrated. So last comment here. He said somebody asked him about his arrest, whether he got careless, whether something else was going on, whether he really had this wish to be captured and put an end to it. And here's what he said. He said, I think some higher power got good and fed up with my activity and decided to put an end to it. I don't really think there were any coincidences. How arrogant and stupid of me to think that I could do something like this and then just go about living life normally as if nothing ever happened. They say you reap what you sow. Well, it's true. You do eventually. So his own words indicate he knew what he was doing, which I guess is part of the reason why he in his trial, he had a lawyer representing him. And against his lawyer's advice, he decided to plead guilty by reason of insanity. To admit, yeah, I did it all, but I was insane. And his comments here show somebody who knew clearly that what they did was wrong. So let's look at Jeremiah 17 for a minute, where we've actually got a contrast that shows a choice. Jeremiah 17, and we're familiar with verse 9. Which says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? Or another translation says, who really knows how bad it is? I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his deeds. And Dahmer did reap the fruit of his deeds, and so do we all. But I hadn't noticed it until the other day when I was looking at this passage again. If we go up a few verses before 17:9, if we go to 17:7, we can either be ruled by our heart, or verse 7 says, blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is in the Lord. He is like a tree planted by water that sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear when heat comes, for its leaves remain green, and is not anxious in the year of drought, for it does not cease to bear fruit. So really the choice is between trusting God or trusting our own heart. And the psalmist said, he that trusts in his own heart is a what? We don't know that passage. He that trusteth in his own heart is a fool, right? And yet the natural bent of every human heart, this came up just a couple minutes ago, Aaron said it, that each human heart has a natural bent, a default mode, if you will, from newborn, infant, child, teenager, and adult to trust what? To trust themselves. Trust my own way of making life work. In our parenting, then, we must realize that the heart of our child is what drives his response to the shaping influences in his life, whether they're well-chosen shaping influences or not. Either your children respond to life, Ted Tripp says, as children of faith who know, love, and serve Jehovah, or they respond as children of foolishness, of unbelief, who neither know him nor serve him. The point is this, they do respond. They are not neutral. They are not simply the sum total of what you and I put into them. They interact with life either out of a true covenant of faith or out of an idol, that's I-D-O-L, covenant of unbelief. It is imperative, Tripp goes on to say, to be clear on this issue. Parenting is not just providing good input. There is another dimension. The child is interacting with the living God. He is either worshiping and serving and growing and understanding of the implications of who God is, or he's seeking to make sense of life without a relationship with God. Part of the parent's task is to shepherd him as a creature who worships, pointing him to the one who alone is worthy of his worship. Now, let me ask you another question. Really, what we're talking about here is a fairly weighty doctrinal notion called original sin, isn't it? Isn't that what we're talking about? Now, I'm not asking anybody to be heretical, but I am asking you to be honest about this. Is there some sense, when we look at particularly babies and small children, in which we find this notion of original sin repugnant and maybe a little unrealistic? You don't have to be a parent to answer that, because we've all interacted with small children. Is there some sense in which we, on a human level, find the notion of original sin maybe repugnant or unrealistic? Nobody here, huh? Rebecca? Yeah, I wasn't being formal about Becky.
I think sometimes it's hard to believe because the children are so limited in their capability to sin. At times, obviously, with an infant, they can't do much anyway. When a child's really young, it can't even see super well. They're just limited in physical capacity, so it's hard to believe, like, this person's sinful because you don't see the physical outworking of that sin.
Okay, so at least for a time, it looks like they're not even capable of it, since they're not capable of much. I mean, what else is true? I mean, what do we think of when we think of newborns? The first thing that comes to your mind is sin, right? I think all parents at some point when they see a newborn probably have difficulty grappling with the reality of this notion. So you guys really want me to call on you? Michelle?
Normally when you think of a baby, you think of innocence.
Yeah, and I mean, is there anything to cement that, or is that just romanticizing the situation?
They really, like, when they're babies, you don't think they could have done much or that they will do much, and they have that cute little face, so why would they do anything?
Danny, yeah.
Being very new to the parenting thing, I can say for myself, I just haven't even thought about it. You know, because you look at him and, like, all you see is goodness and
yes.
cuteness and that sort of thing. But something that what Michelle said triggered in my mind is William Blake, the poet, he basically said that it's the outward influences of culture and society that cause children to lose their innocence. And I think that's the lie that we tend to preach to ourselves. They are little, they are cute, they are good, they're not capable of wrong. And so that's kind of, I think just even now in this moment, that's caused me to think, like, my little guy is not, he's not an angel, even though I think he is.
Enjoy him while he seems to be.
Yeah.
John, okay. Jamin first.
At least for our kids, I think they cross a threshold about 18 months. That first tantrum or that first smack in the face or whatever it happens to be, where it makes it very apparent and obvious that they are sinful creatures. But deeper than that, I think that for me at least, the scripture that God looks on the outside while man is looking on the man's looking on the outside while God is looking on the inside is very apparent, because it is so easy. And even deeper than that, it's sort of this desire to perpetuate the honeymoon, perhaps, of as long as my child is having the appearance of innocence, then I don't have to do all of those really tough parenting things as far as seeking to guide their hearts and teach them of their own sin and teach them of what God demands of them. And so there is even a little bit more of a sinister temptation to perpetuate that as long as possible so I can shirk my duties, as it were.
John?
Oh,
Mel wants equal time.
Well, I'm just going to say, you see that notion of not wanting to accept that later on in life, too. And, you know, you always talk about the mom whose kid could never do anything wrong. And, you know, always wanting to blame the teacher or the friend or whatever for the wrong, mm-hmm. even when it's so apparent that your child is a sinner, you still want to blame something else because you haven't really grappled with that your child is a rebel and a sinner.
Yeah, just other deterministic influences that I didn't have a chance to control.
We're so self-centered as parents that when we view newborns, we're viewing their behavior as how it affects us. The newborn hasn't lied to me. The newborn hasn't disobeyed me. And David in the Psalm says, I've sinned against you, God, and against you only have I sinned. And that newborn, like all of us, is living in a state separated from its creator. And that's the sin, is that the baby, the newborn, and the level we probably can understand, we can't understand this, is trying to exist separate from the control of God.
Excellent, yeah. John Cain.
I think we tend to make the same mistake with newborns that we do with everyone, and that's that we're comparing them to us. So at some level, we've had, you know, 27, 35 years to show how sinful we are. So we're looking at them in comparison to even us, and that gives off a sense of innocence because of the comparison to our own wicked heart.
Jeremy?
The state of sinfulness is also different from acts of sin. So mm-hmm. in a soteriological sense, the plowing of the wicked is sin. on a human level, the plowing of the wicked, well, the wicked is goodness. I mean, those people are taking care of their families. So we're talking about the difference between what we experience as other people's sin, but like John said, the things that offend me versus the state of grace or being out of grace. And children do lots of pleasing things. And we do. That's what you learn as you get older. I mean, to be likable is not the same thing as being good. But that's what social niceties are. You mask in some way your tendency to be selfish and self-centered. And so it's a very few isolated instances where somebody expresses his distance from the Creator.
Yeah, we even sometimes invert it, don't we? Like, that person is so nice. Surely they must be a Christian, right? Yeah, or that Christian's not very nice, so maybe he's not a Christian. What we're dealing with is really hard doctrine. I mean, Psalm 58:3, for instance, is pretty clear. It says, the wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray from birth speaking lies. Now, we either believe that or we don't, right? But I'm saying there is a part of our disposition that wants to say, my children are so nice. My children are so innocent. My children are so sweet. So what are some implications then of the idea that my child doesn't come in to this world neutral? That my child enters life as a sinner whose bent is to try to make life work without God? What are some things that are implied if we believe that? There's some easy ones and there's some hard ones, so you can pick.
An obvious one is that we shouldn't be surprised when our children.
Okay. So this child of mine is no surprise to God. It's right here in the Bible. Okay.
We'll tag team again.
Yeah.
A corollary to that is we should be from day one preaching the gospel to our children.
Yeah, absolutely. And that we're assuming there what? We need to preach the gospel to our children for what reason? Since their default state is not neutral. Sean, you want to answer that one?
I think just as in any other mission field, this is the first, well, not the first mission field God gives us, but the primary mission field God gives us. His hearts are bent to go against God, away from God, from the get-go. So, as Damon said, from day one, it's very important that we're always pointing them towards Christ and towards the cross, even in our discipline we're getting. It's not discipline because, hey, you offended me, or,
yes,
you know what, I'm really embarrassed because you acted out. That's not, or should not be, our intent of discipline. Our intent of discipline is to say, you know, maybe you've offended Dad, but yes, you've offended God, and you've sinned against not just your parents, but against God. So let's point you in the right direction. Let's point you to Christ, point you to the cross, because that's where you need to be, and that's where you need to go.
Excellent. Amen. Anything else that we can think of? So the child is already bent in the wrong direction, and they're already headed for a destination, right? Unless God by His grace intervenes like He did with us. Child going to value our value system? If we're living godly lives, is that going to be important to a child who's bent that direction? They're just going to want to please us all the time, right? For the rest of their lives. That's going to be what drives them. Well, you guys are really quiet today. Danny?
Well, I was just thinking of the passage when Jesus is telling His disciples, suffer the children to come to Me. And that's a command. He was commanding His disciples. He's also commanding us. And what an implication of that statement for me is that not only does Jesus command us and desire us to be bringing our children up to know him, but also that the way that we do that, the way that we teach them not to just do what we say because it's the right thing to do, is to try and teach them a sense of what is coming. Try and teach them a sense of what is true and what is good. And that's that the ultimate goal for our lives is to glorify God so that we can enjoy him and be with him together. That is a greater treasure. So it's giving them a vision of what life is really about, and not and I think that's the trap that a lot of parents tend to fall into, where we're teaching our children to obey us so that they look good and so that we look like we're good parents and we're not getting embarrassed by them. So that's the I think for me, like, that's the point. Giving them a vision of what it really means to love God, and making that the focus, apart from behavior and apart from works, so that as they grow older, it's a natural, starts becoming a more natural desire. They don't, you know, to the extent to where they don't know a different type of lifestyle, to where an ungodly lifestyle is unnatural. Teaching them that we were not created to be sinners. We were created to be in a relationship with God. So teaching them that, you know, that is the point. You know, I think that's you know, a good place to start.
So we weren't created to be sinners, but we are sinners. Our children are sinners. We'll follow up on that in a second. Jeff?
One of the things that I think we do as parents, and this is a really tricky topic to jump into, but is we feel like we don't really have to address the heart until a certain age. I feel like, because the common notion in Christianity is that children go to heaven when they die, and I'm not going to address that one necessarily, that we don't really have to deal with the heart until they get at least, you know, 3, something like that, then we can start trying to teach them the gospel. And obviously, you can make a lot of enemies by differing with that common notion. And there's several different theories out there and what the Bible teaches on that. But if you believe that sin is imputed to my child from birth, then it completely reverses the way that I train my children, because I have to deal with the heart. That is the most critical thing in their life and in my life, is trying to point them towards Christ and praying continually that God will begin to arrest their heart and woo them to himself from that early time, versus dealing with behaviorism until they get 3 years old and, uh-oh, I better try to turn this kid into a Christian.
Somebody else have their hand up? Yeah, Rebecca.
We can do a lot to teach our children, and but I also think that, like we're saying, their bent is to sin, and that's their nature, and we're not going to teach them out of that. Out of that nature, we're not going to be able to, just by teaching them, switch their natures. So, as parents, really, imploring God and begging him that he would use his Spirit to work in their lives, and just to recognize the work of the Spirit in the heart of our children, that transformation has to be a gift of God, that we can provide the influences, we can provide the teaching, but in the end, like, God's going to save them, and it's going to be a work of the Spirit changing their nature and their hearts. And he uses that teaching as a part of that, but in the end it is a work of God. And just, and that's encouraging as a parent, because we don't teach right or we do screw up, but that's the heart of the gospel, and that's where our hope is. So, and also that gives us hope for if my child's not turning out right away, like, God can still do that work later in life, even if we're doing what we consider everything right now. Like, God's still in control.
John, I think one implication is proactive intercessory prayer. I think a lot of times we pray in response to behavior that is obviously evil and bad, but because, like Jeff said, our children are born sinners, we need to pray that God will do a work in their heart that they will never be able to do for themselves, either because of their age or because of their blindness, and a work that we as parents cannot do for them. So
that's a really important notion for us to get as we're talking about parenting.
Yeah, and I, like someone else said, I think we do push off our responsibility to shepherd and pray until there's that age we think the child has reached where they could make a decision, versus praying God's grace and Spirit to work in their lives as soon as he sees fit.
Well, let's transition here. The Tripps, in their more recent book, make this statement. We already said what the bent of our children is. And they say, your children go into the world every day in search of an answer to the question, what makes life worth living? Or maybe on a more practical level, since you can't imagine your two-year-old thinking that, what can I find to excite and delight me? Okay, what pushes my buttons? Now, the Tripps, both in that book and Shepherding a Child's Heart, refer to children as worshipers. I already read something to that extent. Tripp actually says in one place that children are hardwired for worship. Does it seem to you an exaggeration to call what children do worship? So we know their worship is not going to be worshiping God, all right, given that up front here, until they're God's children. But does it seem that what they do, what they engage in, what they seek satisfaction in, does it seem an exaggeration to call that worship? Sean? Back row?
I would just ask them to give it up, whatever they're doing. You'll find out real fast.
Okay, yeah, that's an excellent way of finding out, isn't it? How important is
it? The answer is absolutely. I mean, there's nothing more important to that child than what they're doing right now. You ask them to do something different. You ask them to give that thing up. And in their unregenerate state, you've got a fight on your hands. And I think that's the heart of worship.
Okay. And that's really the core of what we want to talk about for a bit here. I mean, the reality is that does show that our child is attached to something outside of and in some sense bigger than and controlling them, whatever that thing may be. One person has said, we worship whatever rules our time, energy, thoughts, longings, and choices. That's what we worship. So we want to talk here about this notion of worship. I'm going to get real specific in a minute, but I think we got to get a couple of other things out on the table. Let's turn to Romans 1. Let's start in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. Now, verses 19 and 20 then indicate to us that God has already plainly revealed himself in his creation, that his glory is seen plainly. I mean, I may miss getting the point across at any given point in my teaching, but God is the teacher here, and God says, I made that plain. What did he make plain? Well, he made plain a variety of his attributes, right, which we sum up here as his eternal power and divine nature. And the intent here is what? I think it's twofold. Why did God showcase his eternal power and divine nature in the creation? Since there are two answers, either one will work. So that we're without excuse, the passage says. Okay? Now that's the negative, right? That everybody is guilty before God. That nobody will ever be able to say to God, I had no idea you were out there. Right? But is there a positive there too?
He says to bring worshipers to himself.
Yeah, to bring worshipers to himself. Thank you.
And I was going to say the same thing, that before sin, creation was the context for worship. So it's not like the world was created, I mean, if you're speaking to God, the tent was created good. So that was the garden was the place where Adam and Eve communed with the Lord. And it's not until the fall that even the question of the creation still explicating God's nature leave you without excuse when you decide not to worship him. So the point is worship.
Yeah. So God puts some evidence out there apart from his written word that is supposed to lead us to him, to find our joy and happiness in him. Right? So what happens when creatures who've been designed to worship God, as the trips say, to be dazzled by God's greatness, don't do it? Well, what doesn't happen is they don't cease to worship. It's not that somehow in refusing to worship God, they cease worshiping at all. What they do is they worship something that's not God. Right? And the passage goes on to say that. Romans 1, let's pick it up in verse 21. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God. And you notice that given there. They did know God. They did get it. They knew God on some level, that he was responsible for what they were observing and experiencing him. They did not honor him, which was a choice on their part. Did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, birds, animals, and creeping things. The key word there is exchange. They exchanged the glory of God for the worship of created things. And the same truth is repeated down a couple of verses in verse 25, which says they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. So when we worship anything other than the one true God, we're worshiping an idol. For some reason, people today don't seem to be as embarrassed as in previous generations about using the term idol. I mean, consider, for example, the program American Idol, for instance. Or referring to someone as a sports idol and accepting the worship that goes with that if you are the sports idol. We look for, as humans, we look for exceptional achievement to admire. Right? Isn't that true? I think Jeremy a couple of weeks ago was talking about the Olympics and the spectacle on some level that it was. Right? And there's a reason why that gets a big viewing audience. We all like to be impressed. We all like to have something that puts us in admiration, that puts us in awe, that puts us in the mode of saying, that's incredible. Let's play that again. Let's see that again. Can you believe that? So as one person has put it then, idolizing greatness is just innately human. We're made in the image of God and we're engineered for worship, and this looking at greatness and recognizing it as great is what we're wired into. We are fashioned for fascination that His glory is supposed to evoke. And when we see greatness, what really happens is worship. And the question is, worshiping what? Well, there's worship and then there's idolatry, right? There's worshiping God and there is idolatry. And so what would you say is the difference? The object, Sean says. Okay? When does it become idolatry? I mean, the Romans 1 passage says, worship and serve what? When it's idolatry? Lauren? The creature rather than the creator. Right? Do we ever do that? Yeah, I'm afraid we do. Now, this is supposed to be mostly about our kids. But in the Bible, idolatry is used as a term, and it's most frequently a metaphor for loving created things more than we love God. And we all have that problem. Idolatry is not a footnote in our lives. It's where most of us fight the battle. Okay? I mean, what makes you do what you do? Well, it's a choice of things that are ruling you. And why are they ruling you? Because you worship them. So let me ask this. We're going to be talking about idols and our kids for the next couple of minutes. What's the biggest barrier to seeing the idols in our kids? As parents, we're responsible for identifying them and helping them to see that what they're doing is worshiping an idol. Aaron?
I suppose it would be it would be a failure to recognize the idols in our own life.
I think that's right on the money. The intent is that at some point future we will talk about our own idols. We might want now to focus on our kids, but yeah. When we have so many idols in our own lives that we don't recognize as being idols, how do we expect to be perceptive about the idols in our kids' lives? Along with that, when we're still invoking ourselves here, what's the biggest barrier to leading our kids to Christ? We've already recognized in very, very helpful comments that this is not just all about parental orchestration here of a decision. What we're talking about is a child being drawn by the Spirit of God into a relationship with the living God. It's not something we can do. That's the gospel playing out. We've been told to do something in parenting our children that we can't really do, right? Same thing as living the Christian life. God says to do certain things, and the doing is where it all falls apart, right? But God is quite willing to step in. He wants to show us our continuing dependency on Him. So what's the biggest barrier to leading our kids to Christ? Sean?
I think it's our own failings, our own lack of dependence on Christ for what we need, and our inconsistencies and those idols that we have in our own lives.
Okay.
And they see us as a... I mean, we lead them by word, but often not by action.
Yeah, am I the only parent who ever said something spiritual to a child, and as I was saying it, I got kind of this feedback in my head that said, those are nice words. Too bad you don't practice them. Right? And the older your kids get, the more they see the disconnect between what you're telling them and what actually is supreme and ruling your life. So I think we could say it's our own lack of satisfaction with God that we pursue other things because we don't find satisfaction in God. Well, that's absolutely true, and that's going to undergird everything else. But for the moment, let's move to idols. Can we recognize some idols that might be idols in our children? Not to say these are not idols in us as well. Somebody suggest an idol that children might have. I hear Rhett says self. You want a microphone and expand on that? I'll give you a moment while the microphone's coming around. So I idolize myself. What does that look like?
It looks like for Connie in the classroom right now, 2 3-year-olds fighting over the same toy. I love myself. I deserve it. I want it. I should have it.
Okay.
And that is a very simplified example, but that's true throughout a lot of our lives.
And do some kids get involved in playing that idea of self in a slightly different way? In other words, since Miss Connie is refereeing in there with her armor on, do some kids, let's call them good kids for the present here, have some way of using the system
They think I'll give up whatever this is to get the love of another creature.
Okay. Miss Connie is pleased when I show deference to whoever in here, and it's more important to me to please Miss Connie than it is for me to have that thing. Miss Connie is really grateful. That's true for George. It works. So isn't there a sense? I mean, you can see when one of these kids has been violated. So definitely self, my own self, self-interest. But sometimes it gets a little bit more sophisticated, and it's my sense of fairness, right? Hey, like, I just played by all the rules here, and now I'm getting this kind of treatment here, you know? I mean, we all know how this is supposed to work, and I've been playing by the rules here. It's my sense of fairness that is violated here. In fact, I saw an outrageous example of this on Friday night at a family birthday party. My grandson, Ethan, was 6, and we had his birthday party with the rest of the family. And the presents were about what you would predict. The theme was Batman, by the way. So we all, you know, had black plates and so forth. But his 10-year-old sister, my oldest granddaughter, was there, behaving herself, acting like a nice, responsible child. And we got through the presents, and we got to the end. The really good one was right at the end. And the really good one shocked his sister. The really good one was something that his sister had been saving money for and told by the parents many times, we don't have enough money to buy you one of those. It was financed largely by the extended family, and it was a Nintendo DS. And as soon as that came out of the package, we got a shriek from the 10-year-old. She fell to the floor, burst out crying, and she said, that's not fair! She was dismissed to her room to collect herself. We've all been there, haven't we? Right? Been playing by the rules. I've been doing chores. I've been accumulating money. You've been telling me how we don't have money for this kind of thing. And then this happens? right? So fairness can be an idol. Huh? Anything else we can think of? Chris?
I was just thinking, sometimes when Marshall is disobeying or about to disobey for the second or third or fourth time in a row, you know, like, we'll approach again, you know, with the, you know, oncoming slap of the hand or, you know, something, a big no or something, and he, it's like he knows it's coming, and he'll try to, like, like counter attack it with like the hug, like, oh, you know, like like, oh no, I'm really sorry, you know. And then he, like, he doesn't say that, of course, not yet, but you know, he knows it's coming, he knows he's doing wrong, he knows that there's some form of punishment coming again, but he's like, oh, I'm gonna trick him this time, I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna give him the hug, I'm gonna, you know, do the cute thing or whatever, puppy dog eyes or whatever. You know, because he knows, like, it might work, like, half the time. And it's that, like, if it, when it happens, I'm like, you are evil. Like, you know. Like, you're just like me. Like, you're just like me. You're just like anyone, you know. You know how to get your way, you know. Even when, like, you're in a pinch and you know that, like, you're going to get what you deserve. You know, you're trying to wiggle your way out of it. And, yeah, it blows my mind that, like, he's so little and he knows that he can do that, you know. It's really crazy.
So we're talking about essentially control. Yep. That I'm really in control in this situation. I mean, they're bigger than me, you know, faster, etc., but I'm in control. Let me throw one out, which is probably one that most people miss according to the trips, and I think they're right. And that's performance. Performance. Let me read what they have to say. Perhaps your child is only happy if he can excel, run faster, jump higher, or spell better than others. I was more the last one, personally. Run faster, jump higher didn't work too well for me, but spell better, that could work. Parents and teachers miss these idols because a driven child is not a management problem. In fact, most adults polish this idol. We like it when our children excel, don't we? Our children like it, and we like it. So that one shouldn't be called an idol. We should erase that one from the list. What's idolatrous about that? Jennifer.
Well, I think mostly it just boils down to selfishness and glory and self above other, you know, kind of like the whole humanism movement, you know, glorying in your own personal achievements. Kind of thing. I can kind of relate to that in that my sister is very gifted intellectually, and I think that she bases a lot of her abilities based on that. You know, I can do all these things. I'm not the same as everybody else because I'm a really smart person, you know, whatever. So, you know, she's a teenager, so she's, you know, and I guess my parents reward her for that kind of, you know, you do well in school, so therefore, you know, we don't have to worry about you.
Yeah, equates with being a responsible person. And I could use responsibility as a way to get what I want. Becky?
Well, first of all, I just want to say I'm still in shock that the Dances kids are innocent until 18 months old.
Yeah, I had that same reaction for myself.
I'm thinking, man, I got a dance.
Not because of observing their kids.
I struggled even with talking with moms here and hearing different people say, well, my kid knows all the alphabet. I mean, or my kid can count the bus. And I'm thinking, well, Kathy can't do that yet. And you start worrying, like, is my kid not, like, with it, and then you think, well, Catherine knows her colors. Or, you know, you want your kid to mm-hmm. excel, and this must be hard because we do want our kids to learn. We want them to do well. So, of course, that would be very easy to mask, and it's something that everyone pleases you for, so why wouldn't you want to do well? But I know already it's been a struggle for me, so of course you want your kid to be the best soccer player, the best piano player. It only
Yeah, and
sense.
We want them to develop their God-given abilities. That's the snare here. Rebecca?
I think it's really crippling when they don't, and you've been pushing them to do this. And if they're that personality that thinks that they should be excelling and they just fall apart when it doesn't work out. I remember last year I was spending some time with my two nephews, and they were trying to play basketball, and my one nephew just could not get the ball in the hoop. And, of course, it's like 6 feet high. He's not going to, but he had set up that goal for himself and just could not perform in that way, and it just was a complete meltdown and breakdown. And when we give our children these standards and we push performance, then we're setting them up for failure.
Jeremy?
The trap there for the parent is, you know, it's probably so obvious, it's dumb to say, but you know, when you do something that makes you look good and it also makes me look good, then we're on the same page. So you're not challenging that behavior. And, I mean, everybody knows, like, the cliche of the soccer dad that's out there screaming at the coach and screaming at the refs, you're killing my kid's chances to get into, you know, six-year-old soccer. And, it's almost like, oh, yeah, he's projecting his future major league soccer career that the dad never got to, you know, achieve it. It's so silly, but, you know, we do that. We want our kids to achieve, to make us look good, too, and you project your children's accomplishments, sort of voyeuristically participate in their success. My child is genetically superior, you know, whatever.
Danny?
I was just going to say, I think, many times parents facilitate the idolatry of their children. Just a specific example I have in my mind was a little 12-year-old girl whose parents were very hard on her to excel academically. And, you know, there was some manipulation going on, and so when she achieved success, you know, the whole family was happy and everything was okay. When she failed, at first, you know, they were really disappointed. Now, they tend to comfort her and say, it's okay, you don't have to be as good as everyone else, and they pat themselves on the back for making her feel better. Even though it was their fault to begin with. So, you know, for me, that's an object lesson to, you know, not push my child because of my own ideas of what's going to make her look good, what's going to make me look good, what's going to make him feel better about himself as a, you know, 10-year-old, 12-year-old kid.
I'm Janine up front. George?
I think I'm forced too, to think back to my time as a counselor at the Wilds and say, whether therefore ye eat or drink or whatsoever ye do, do all to the glory of God. So what's the motivation behind the performance? That's got to be the bottom line, because you can't just sit and say, well, performance is bad then, because it's not, but it can't be an idol if you're doing it for God's glory. I know we often tell our kids it's not that a B is a bad grade, but is that your best before the Lord? Were you conscientious every day on your schoolwork looking towards doing your best as to the Lord. It's not about unto men that you can say, look at me, I have all A's, but was that your best that day? Did you give your best to the Lord? So performance isn't bad in and of itself. It's when it becomes the object, your idol, and that's all you're looking at. If your motivation is to do it as to the Lord, then it's not a wrong thing, but keeping our motives in check always has to be the key.
Great. The way the trips summarize this, and we'll close down here, although there are lots of other idols we could talk about. This was kind of a telling statement, since I already admitted to you that I'm involved in this performance thing. They say the person who has God plus every imaginable skill and ability has no more than the person who has only God. Did you get that? The person who has God plus every imaginable skill and ability has no more than the person who has only God. If you quarrel with that statement in your mind, as I did when I first read it, what are you doing with these skills and abilities? See, they're not something God gave you that you're accountable to use to glorify God. You think you have meaning and significance in those things independently of God. There is no such thing. So let me close by giving us a great example of what could happen if our children really love God from their hearts. When your child has a heart that worships God, he's willing to do hard things that God asks of him. I'm going to read a little bit, part of a letter that Jim Elliot wrote to his parents about his call to go to South America. And should preface this by saying that he wrote this when he was 22. And he was already recognized for leadership ability in many different spheres, could have been probably successful in stateside ministry. And when he told his parents that he felt called to go to the Quechua Indians in South America, they weren't very excited about that. And they wrote and told him so. That was before telephones, you know. No, not quite. It was expensive. So here was his answer to them, to their disappointment. He says, "I do not wonder that you are saddened at the word of my going to South America. This is nothing else than what the Lord Jesus warned us of when he told the disciples that they must become so infatuated with the kingdom and following him that all other allegiances must become as though they were not. And he never excluded the family tie. In fact, those loves that we regard as closest, he told us, must become as hate in comparison with our desires to uphold his cause. Grieve not, then, if your sons seem to desert you, but rejoice rather, seeing the will of God done gladly. Remember how the psalmist described children? He said that they were as an heritage from the Lord, and that every man should be happy who had his quiver full of them. And what is a quiver full of but arrows? And what are arrows for but to shoot? So with the strong arms of prayer, draw back the bowstring and let the arrows fly, all of them, straight at the enemy's hosts. Give of thy sons to bear the message glorious. Give of thy wealth to speed them on their way. Pour out thy soul for them in prayer victorious, and all thou spendest, Jesus will repay." And John Piper, who quoted that, says, "Where will they come from? That kind of 22-year-old doesn't grow on trees. Where do they come from?" The answer is that they come from God. Not from parenting. God makes hearts like that. And he's sovereign. He can make such a heart in a dysfunctional family and a failing church. But that is not his ordinary way. And it is not the way he commands. His ordinary way is to breed hearts like that in God-exalting families and churches where one generation shall praise your works to another. Pray with me. Our Heavenly Father, we confess that as adults, we really haven't been consumed with the great love with which you've loved us. It is so easy for us to become distracted by the cares of this life, by our own limitations, and to effectively fail to carry out our own responsibilities. But we know from trying and failing that we are unable, that we are not up to the task that you've given us as parents. Part of the reason for our discouragement is that we don't spend time with you. Help us to meditate on the splendor of your majesty and on your wonderful works to the children of men, including our children. Help the reality of your redemptive work in Christ to pervade everything that we do. Would it transform our attitudes and actions? And Lord, most of all, would you help our children to see you in spite of our failings, in spite of the way in which we are not effective representatives for you? May our minds be directed in such a way, all of us, adults and children alike, to say truthfully with the psalmist, Lord, who do we have in heaven but you? And on earth we don't desire anything besides you. Our flesh and our heart may fail, but you, our God, are the strength of our heart and our portion forever. In Jesus' name, amen.